The Dharma Talk, delivered by Venerable Usilananda at the Tathagata Meditation Center, San Jose, California, Special Retreat of November 1998.
So, Venerable Sariputta pointed out to the monks the mental states that are to be abandoned, and also he said there is the middle way that gives vision and so on. So yesterday I explained these qualities of the middle way or the eightfold path, which is supramundane. So today I will explain these qualities in relation to the mundane eightfold path or the preliminary eightfold path. The Noble Eightfold Path is the group of eight mental states that arise at the moment of enlightenment, at the moment of the arising of path consciousness. But in order for that path consciousness to arise, one has to practice the Eightfold Path, which is preliminary to the path consciousness. And that Eightfold Path, which is preliminary, is the practice of Satipatthana or Vipassana meditation. These qualities that are described of the Noble Eightfold Path can be applied to the preliminary Eightfold Path also. It gives vision. That means it gives seeing. It gives extraordinary seeing, not ordinary seeing. And the second is it gives knowledge. These two mean the same thing. And then the fourth is it gives direct knowledge. Again, it means the same thing, and also it leads to the penetrating knowledge. Now these four qualities mean just the same thing, that is, it gives understanding, it gives knowledge. It gives knowledge which can be gained only through the practice of vipassana. Yogi practices vipassana meditation when he tries to be mindful of the objects, or when he make notes of the object. So in the beginning, he may not see in his mental eye, he may not see the objects clearly. But as his practice goes on, and when his concentration becomes strong, then he will be able to see the objects clearly and distinctly. See something and he makes notes of it. He sees that seeing is the object that is seen is one thing, and seeing is another. And the mindfulness of seeing is still another. So he sees these two things clearly. He hears something and makes notes as hearing. He sees that the noise or sound he hears is one thing, and the hearing is another, and the mindfulness of hearing is still another. The breaths, he sees that in breath is one thing, and the mindfulness of in-breath is another, out-breath is one thing, mindfulness of out-breath is another. In the same way, when he makes notes of the rising and falling of the abdomen, he sees that rising is one thing and mindfulness of rising is another, falling is one thing and mindfulness of falling is another. So he sees these things separately, distinct from each other. Object he observes, he sees that object is one thing, and the noting of that object or mindfulness of that object is another. So he sees the subject and object are going in pairwise occurrence. He makes notes of the rising and falling of the abdomen. He sees that rising has no cognitive power. Rising does not know anything, but the mind knows the rising. So the mind has a cognizing power, and the rising has no cognitive power. This also he comes to see when he pays close attention to the rising and falling of the abdomen. Is that mind is something that takes the object, that goes to the object, or that inclines towards the object. And the matter is something that does not know anything. And noting mind in this way, he is said to gain the knowledge of discerning mind and matter. That means he is now able to see mind and matter clearly, one distinct from the other. It is because he pays attention to the objects, or he practices vipassana meditation. Before he practiced vipassana meditation, he was not able to see mind and matter this clearly, or he did not see that this is mind or this is matter. But now he practices vipassana, and he sees the nature of mind, and he sees the nature of matter. And so this seeing, or this understanding, he gains through the practice of vipassana meditation. And so vipassana meditation is said to give seeing or vision to the practitioner. Seeing is not an ordinary seeing. Only those who practice meditation can see mind and matter this much clearly. So this is an extraordinary knowledge a yogi gains through practice of vipassana meditation. Stop there. So as he goes on, he will come to see that because there is something to be noted, there is the noting. Because there is a breath, there is the mindfulness of breath. Because there is the rising and falling, there is the noting of or mindfulness of rising and falling. He also knows that because there is the intention, say, to stretch, there is stretching. Because there is intention to bend, there is bending, and so on. Comes to see the conditionality of things. He sees that everything arises dependent upon some conditions, and nothing arises without conditions. So he clearly sees for himself, not through thinking or not through logic, but through direct experience, that all things are conditioned. Another extraordinary understanding he gains from the practice of Vipassana meditation. He sees mind and matter clearly. He also sees that there are just these two things, mind and matter, going on at every moment. And there is nothing apart from mind and matter. There is no permanent entity or no other administering the seeing and so on. So when he sees that there are just mind and matter going on and on and on, and he is able to discard the wrong notion that there is a permanent entity or there is an utter, say, controlling or administering his seeing and so on. And when he sees the conditionality of things, or when he sees that there are just cause and effect going on and on, he is able to discard doubts about whether there is a person or not. He is able to discard the doubts about whether there was a person in the past or whether there will be a person in the future. Because now he sees that there is no person, just mind and matter, just cause and effect going on. And so he had no doubt about there being no person or no individual, just the mind and matter, or just cause and effect, arising and disappearing, arising and disappearing. He goes along, he will also see the objects arising and disappearing. Whatever object he puts his mind on, that object, he knows that that object arises and then it disappears. So when he sees objects arising and disappearing, he is convinced of the one common characteristic of all conditioned phenomena, that is impermanence. So when he sees objects as coming and going, arising and disappearing, he knows that these objects are impermanent. He also sees the dukkha nature of things. Now here dukkha nature means being oppressed by arising and disappearing, not painfulness or not suffering, but being oppressed by, being bombarded by arising and disappearing. That is what we should understand as suffering. And when he sees objects as impermanent and suffering, he also sees that they just arise and disappear. He has no control over them. He cannot make the impermanent permanent. He cannot make the suffering non-suffering. So he sees this anatta nature of things also when he sees the other two characteristics. Objects he is observing as impermanent, suffering and non-soul, he is able to see by inference that the objects in the past must also be impermanent and so on, and the objects in the future must also be impermanent and so on. So he sees the impermanent suffering and non-soul nature of things of the present and of the past and of the future. And this seeing or this understanding, it's very precious to him. This understanding he gets only through the practice of Vipassana meditation. He cannot get this kind of understanding just by reading a book or just by listening to a talk. He gets this extraordinary knowledge of mind and matter only through the practice, the practice of Eightfold Path or practice of Vipassana meditation. So said that it leads to the cessation of mental defilements. The practice of Vipassana leads to the cessation of mental defilements. Now, the other day I told you about latency of mental defilements in objects. And I also told you that Vipassana can avoid latency of mental defilements in objects. That is actually the power of Vipassana to abandon the mental defilements. But that abandonment is not final. It is momentary abandonment. Let us say a yogi make notes of a beautiful object. Since he is making notes, or since he is applying mindfulness, he is able to prevent attachment from arising regarding that object. That is, he is able to abandon the mental defilement regarding that object by practice of mindfulness or Vipassana meditation. And the last quality given is it leads to Nibbana. That means it leads to total cessation of aggregates. Now, when a yogi is able to avoid mental defilements from arising regarding an object, he is able to prevent karma from arising, because karma depends on the mental defilements. So when karma is avoided, its results that would arise in the future are also said to be avoided. So by not letting mental defilements arise with regard to an object, a yogi is virtually abandoning the aggregates that would arise in the future. So that is what we call Nibbana for a yogi. It is not a real Nibbana, but it is like a Nibbana to him, because he is able to achieve non-arising of aggregate in the future. If he continues his practice, then he will get more insight into the nature of mind and matter. He will gain more extraordinary knowledge regarding the mind and matter. And when his practice of Vipassana meditation becomes mature, then the noble Eightfold Path will arise as an outcome of the practice of Vipassana meditation. So when that arises, the noble Eightfold Path arises, then that noble Eightfold Path is fully developed. During the period of Vipassana meditation, he is developing these eight factors of the Eightfold Path. And when they become mature and arise as the Noble Eightfold Path, then they are fully developed. So when they are fully developed, they take Nibbana as object and not mind and matter as object. So the difference between the difference of object between the preliminary Eightfold Path and Noble Eightfold Path is that the object of preliminary Eightfold Path is the five aggregates, or mind and matter, or formations. And the object of the Noble Eightfold Path is Nibbana. This Eightfold Path, as the name indicates, has eight parts, or eight factors. And they are right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. These factors are all working together and harmoniously when a yogi practices vipassana meditation. So when you practice vipassana meditation, you are practicing the Eightfold Path. Okay, let us see how they arise. When you practice vipassana, you try to be mindful. So in order to be mindful, you have to make an effort. Without making an effort, you cannot be mindful. So that effort is what is called right effort. So you make the effort, and so you are able to watch the object, or you are able to be mindful of the object. That means your mind hits the object. And that the hitting the object with your mind, or your mind hitting the object, is what we call right mindfulness. And when mindfulness hits the object, that means reaches the object, then another mental state keeps the mind and its components on the object, and it does not let it to go to other objects, and also it does not let the components scatter. So it keeps the components compact and also stuck to the object. And that mental state is what we call samadhi, concentration. So that is right concentration. When you are concentration becomes strong, the mental hindrances are subdued. Before you get concentration, there are mental hindrances in your mind. Mental hindrances are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor. What else? Distraction and worry, or remorse and doubt, right? So these are called mental hindrances. They hinder or they block the way to samadhi. But when mindfulness becomes strong and also samadhi becomes strong, then these are subdued. When they are subdued, mind becomes calm and quiet and, say, clean. It is a time when yogis begin to see the true nature. They begin to see mind clearly, matter clearly, and that they are interdependent and so on. So, through concentration, yogis come to see the true nature of things. And that seeing the true nature of things, seeing the objects clearly, and seeing that they are dependent on other conditions, and seeing that they are impermanent and so on, is what we call right understanding. So right understanding comes only when there is right concentration. And right concentration will be there only when there is right mindfulness. And right mindfulness can be there only when you make effort. So how many factors do you have now? Five factors. These five factors are actively working at every moment of your meditation. And these five are called worker factors. Four. There is one more. Okay. There is another mental state that has the function of taking the mind to the object. It's very delicate. The mental states arising together and each doing its own function separately. So mindfulness is hitting the object, and concentration keeps the mind on the object, and the understanding sees the true nature of things, and the understanding to see the true nature of things, mind must be on the object, mind must reach the object. And this mental state has the function of taking the mind to the object. If it does not take the mind to the object, then mind cannot be on the object, and so there can be no understanding. And that mental state is what is called right thought among the eight factors. So right thought means not right thinking. Not right thinking. But actually, it is a mental state called vitakka. It is translated as initial application of mind to the object. So this is where the mental state vitakka, which is called right thought here. And right this mental state has a function of taking the mind to the object. So if it doesn't take it, the mind to the object, mind does not reach the object, and so there will be no understanding. That is why this mental state is also an important factor, and it is coupled with understanding. I'll explain it later. Three factors: right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right understanding, and right thought are called worker factors. And they must work in harmony. So one must not work in excess. So if any one of is in excess, then your meditation goes out of order. Now, especially important is the right concentration and right effort. Sometimes there is an excess of right effort, and sometimes there is an excess of concentration. So when there is too much effort, then you feel agitated and you cannot concentrate. And when there is too much concentration, your right effort, the level of your right effort goes down. So that means you become sleepy or you become lazy, because it has become so easy for you to concentrate that you lose the necessary amount of effort. So when there is too much concentration, then you feel sleepy, or you may be nodding or something like that. And when there is too much effort, there is agitation, and so you cannot concentrate. So these two must be balanced, one not in excess of the other. So when they are balanced, then your meditation goes well. Now, where are the other three? Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Strictly speaking, according to Abhidhamma, they are not present. Now, in order to understand this, you must first understand right speech and so on. So right speech, according to Abhidhamma, right speech means abstention from wrong speech, abstention from telling lies and others. And right action means abstention from wrong action, like killing, stealing, and so on. And right livelihood means abstention from wrongdoings by body or by speech, which are your livelihood. So a right livelihood right livelihood is abstention from the same seven misconducts, four by speech and three by body. So right livelihood is abstention from the same seven misconducts. But the difference is, if that misconduct is not your livelihood, then it is either right speech or right action. But if that one of that misconduct is your livelihood, then abstention from that that misconduct is called right livelihood. For example, you are a fisherman, then you abstain from killing fish. So when you abstain from killing fish, you practice right livelihood. But another person who is not a fisherman, maybe he goes fishing once in a while, and then he refrains from killing fish. So when he refrains from killing fish, he is practicing right action, not right livelihood. So that is the difference. If the something you refrain from is your livelihood, and that is right livelihood. If it is not your livelihood, but you abstain from it, then it is either right speech or right action. The misconducts they refrain from are different. These three cannot arise at the same time. They arise one at a time, and they arise only when you refrain from bodily misconduct or verbal misconduct or from your livelihood. If you are not refraining from these misconducts, they do not arise in your mind. Suppose you have an occasion to kill a being, and you abstain from killing that being. So when you abstain from killing that being, then you practice right action. But you are sitting here practicing meditation. You have no occasion to kill any being. So strictly speaking, they do not arise when you are practicing vipassana. But those who practice vipassana meditation has to purify their sila or moral conduct before they practice vipassana. That is why I have you take precepts every day. So when you take precepts, then it is like abstaining from these misconducts. So we can say that before you practice vipassana, when you take precepts, these three factors are accomplished. So actually you are practicing only five factors. So three are already accomplished. So we can say that you practice eight factors. Now these eight factors are grouped into three groups, right? Sila, I mean, group of moral conduct, group of concentration, and group of wisdom. So the three just mentioned belong to what group? Sila group, right? Abstain, right action, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And which factors belong to concentration group? Right concentration, right mindfulness, and right effort. Right mindfulness is mindfulness and not concentration, and right effort is effort and it's not concentration, but they help, they support concentration, because without them concentration cannot arise. Since they are supporters of concentration, they are grouped in the concentration group. So these three belong to, or these three are grouped as concentration group. Belong to wisdom group, right understanding and right thought. So right thought is not wisdom, not understanding, but it helps right understanding to arise, and so it is included, grouped together with understanding. So there are three groups, although there are eight factors, and they are grouped into three: a group of sila, samadhi, and panya, to attack the three levels of mental defilements. Now you know the three levels of mental defilements. What is the uppermost level? You do something, right? Transgression level, and then lower level, arising level, and latent level, the deepest level. So in order to attack the transgression level, the three factors of sila are given. So by practicing sila, by taking precepts and keeping them, you can avoid transgressing. And in order to deal with the second level, the arising level, the concentration factors are given. So when you are mindful, when you make effort, and when you are mindful, and when your mind is concentrated, then mental defilements don't arise. So they can deal with the arising of, or they can prevent the arising of mental defilements. But they can prevent just the arising of mental defilements for some time, not permanent. When there are conditions, the mental defilements will arise again. So in order to destroy the mental defilements once and for all, the group of wisdom, two factors are given. So these two factors are to deal with the deepest level of mental defilement, that is latent level. So only the wisdom, or only right understanding that arises at the moment of path consciousness, can eradicate that deepest level, the latent level of mental defilements. So vipassana cannot do that. Vipassana can deal with them just momentarily. So vipassana is called momentary abandoning. Said in the Dhammapada that this eightfold path is the only way, and there is no other way for the purification of visions, that means for the purification of knowledge. That means for enlightenment. So in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, Buddha said this is the only way. But in Dhammapada, Buddha said this is the only way and there is no other. So Buddha is very emphatic in the Dhammapada. So, and also Buddha declared to the ascetic Subhadda, who came to him when he was on his deathbed, just a few hours away from death. So Buddha declared to that ascetic that the Eightfold Path is found in his teachings only. They are not found in the teachings of other religious teachers. And that is why there can be those who have eradicated mental defilements in the dispensation of Buddha only. Venerable Sariputta encouraged the monks to practice three kinds of seclusion following the example of the Buddha, and also to abandon the unwholesome mental states. And for the abandonment of those unwholesome mental states, he said there is this middle way, or the Eightfold Path. And he pointed out the mental states that are to be abandoned. And how many have we met? Only two, right? Greed and hate, right? Only two. So there are 14 more. Okay, I cannot talk in great detail now. So greed and hate are one pair. So, but Venerable Sariputta said, greed is evil, hate is evil, and there is this way to abandon them, and this is the Noble Eightfold Path. And then he said, anger is evil and grudge is evil. So anger and grudge. Now, hate is also anger. So maybe they are overlapping. So getting angry with any person, then we can take anger, and then the other one is grudge. That means binding another person with anger or something like that. So that is grudge. So anger and grudge are also the evil mental state, and we can abandon these two by the practice of the middle way. Ingratitude and competitiveness, not in a good sense. So the first one is ingratitude. The Pali word is makkha. The makkha means crushing. So crushing some good turn made to you by another person. So although somebody may have done something, some favor to you, you will not acknowledge that. And so that is called makkha in Pali. And so we shall translate it as ingratitude. And the other is competing with another person, competing on the same level, on the basis of same level. Although, say, I may not be equal with that person, I want to compete with him, something like that. So that is one evil state, and these two evil states are to be eradicated by the practice of middle way. envy and avarice. Now, envy is jealousy. So, we don't like when the other person is prosperous or successful. So that is called envy or jealousy. And the other is avarice. What is avarice? Now, the Pali word is machira. It is intolerance of one's property being common to others. So it is like stinginess, but not attachment. Not just attachment to the property or to the thing, but it is a kind of dosa. So, suppose I'm very much attached to this. I'm really attached. it has served me for 20 years now, almost 20 years. So, let's say I'm attached to it. Then, if somebody comes and use it, I don't like it. So that is avarice. Yeah, that is macharya. Now, say, people are say devoted to me. Then, if they are devoted to another person, I don't like it. So that is macharya. I mean, avarice. So, possessiveness, yeah. But I want to make sure you understand this, right? Possessiveness may mean stinginess, right? Loba, but it is not loba. It is part of dosa. Yeah, don't want to share. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to share. And if someone comes and share it, you don't like it, and you have a kind of aversion. So that is machira or machiriya in Pali. Next pair is deceit and fraud. Now, deceit means concealing one's faults, concealing what evil one has done. So that is called deceit here. And fraud means showing non-existent qualities in oneself. That means a person is not a yogi, but he may show himself as a yogi. So that is a fraud. Pretense? Something like that, huh? Okay. So they can be eradicated by the practice of middle way. Now the next pair is obstinacy and it's translated as presumption. That is also very difficult. Now, obstinacy is understandable, right? Yeah, stubbornness. what do you call? Being hard. So, and the other thing is, there may be an English word, I cannot find it. That is doing something in excess. Suppose, say, over exertion.
Is it translation?
No.
Presumption?
Yes, presumption.
Assuming something that
than others.
Presumption?
So suppose you walk 1 mile, I will walk 2 miles, something like that. So doing in excess of others, in competition with that person. So that is what is meant here.
Presumption.
But I don't think that is accurate. Yeah.
Competitive or
rival? This can be also wholesome. So you practice for 1 hour and I practice for 2 hours. So that kind of thing is called sarambha in Pali.
So in a colloquial expression, it's overdoing it.
Okay. Okay. So we are close to the end. And then the next is conceit and excessive conceit. So that is easy to understand. Pride, conceit, and excessive conceit. Here is intoxication with pride and negligence. Now, the last one is the most important. It is the opposite of mindfulness. So negligence is defined as letting one's mind loose on the five desirable objects of the senses. Now, there are desirable objects, and you do not control your mind, and you let you let loose your mind, you know, to enjoy as much as you like, and so on. So that is called negligence here. And also, we can interpret it in many ways, right? So you don't want to practice meditation, and that is negligence, or you fail to note, or you're lazy to note, and that is also negligence. You don't want to do practice sila, that is negligence. So there are a lot of examples of negligence, or what do you call it? Pamada. So the last is pair is that the intoxication with pride and negligence. Venerable Sariputta pointed out these 16 mental states, and they are termed evil. So these evil mental states are to be eradicated by following the practice of the middle way. Now, as I have explained, the Noble Eightfold Path is just the outcome of the preliminary path. And so what we should really practice is not the Noble Eightfold Path. We cannot practice Noble Eightfold Path because the Noble Eightfold Path is the outcome. What we can do, what we can practice is the preliminary Eightfold Path, which is Vipassana meditation. So only by the practice of Vipassana meditation can we eradicate these evil mental states. And when we at least try to eradicate these evil mental states, then we are following in the footsteps of the Buddha in practicing mental seclusion. So when we practice Vipassana meditation, we are trying to eradicate these mental defilements. We are trying to reach the path and fruition, and we are trying to realize Nibbana, which are the real Dhamma heritage. So when we practice Vipassana meditation, we are taking the Dhamma heritage, not the real Dhamma heritage, but we are trying to making effort to take the Buddha's Dhamma heritage. And so this is the only way by which we can take the real Dhamma heritage of the Buddha. So following the advice of the Buddha and following the teachings of the Venerable Sariputta, we will make effort to take the Dhamma heritage of the Buddha. We will try as much as we can to get rid of or to abandon the evil mental states, and we will take Buddha's teaching seriously, we will not go after the material gains, and we will try to reach Nibbana by the practice of an eightfold, the preliminary eightfold path, or by the practice of Vipassana meditation. And let us hope that we get the Dhamma heritage of the Buddha in this very life.